Thank you for listening to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Sign up to our Patreon to receive bonus content, live streams, and our weekly newsletter with money off books and museum visits as well, plus early access to all live show tickets. That's patreon.com/wehaveways.
Ostrozhnost, Ostrozhnost, which is, of course, Russian for Achtung, Achtung. Hello, and welcome to We Have Ways of Making You Chalk, yet another punnily entitled, load-bearing pun title, We Have Ways of Making You Talk, to celebrate and simultaneously mourn the absence of the Chalk Valley History Festival.
Oh, it's so this week is so, the weather's just so perfect for having a festival on a big field in England.
I know. This is the thing. When we the other day we were in Wiltshire looking at the T-34, which I think will have gone out once this goes out. So we can talk about this like it's happened. Rachel brought us lunch, and she was, I said, oh, you know, how is it with there being no festival? Thinking there might be a little bit of, oh, it's such a relief not to have to worry about Portaloos. But she was very sad about it. And, I mean, it's the sort of pinnacle of your year, isn't it, Jim?
Well, it is in a way, yeah. And I mean, can I just point out that usually the kind of sort of, I love the festival too, I hate the festival and I never want to do it again, is about 99-1 in favour of the hating bit. As far as Rachel's concerned. I mean, Rachel is always cursing the History Festival. And now suddenly, when it's been taken away from her, she's all kind of sort of, oh, I'm really missing it this year.
That's wonderful.
That's good.
Increases the chances of its return. Well, I mean, what you don't want is a year off and you think, oh, why did we ever bother with that?
Well, Rachel does all the operations. So she's in charge of all the site, the whole thing, and actually the thing that makes it work, plus the schools festival, which is the kind of really important bit in a way. Yeah. So she has almost the most important job of all.
But anyway. Right. Now, today, having played around with the T-34, I think it's only really appropriate that today we move our sights to the Eastern Front, which our regular listeners on We Have Ways of Making You Talk on the podcast and on the Patreon say we neglect sometimes because...
Yeah. Shocking.
We have it is shocking. And that voice you hear there is Alex Ritchie, who is here to help us redress that balance and turn our attention towards the Eastern Front. In particular, Operation Bagration. Have I pronounced that right, Alex?
You can say Bagration, you can say Bag of Rations, you can say Bagration, you can play with it any way you want to. But the Russian would be Bagration, named after an obscure general that Stalin decided was the person to whom this battle should be named for. So I'm really upset about the Chalk Valley not going ahead either, because I was supposed to be in the T-34 crew. All-female crew.
Yes, you are.
And I'm bereft. I'm bereft. I've got little bits.
Wearing your tanker's uniform.
I know. I just, you know, it would have been so much more fun than you know, looking at my little bits of tank track, which I've got here in my study, but that's not really the same, is it? I mean, it's not quite, you know, like driving the T-34, the fumes and the stench and the you know, would have been great.
The stench was terrible.
Yes.
How tall are you, Alex? That's my main concern. Now you're talking, because I'm 6'3". James is a similar height, and we found it
impossible.
Very sort of elbows and banged heads and scuffed
well,
foreheads.
Well, I've got the great good fortune of knowing a chap here who runs the tank museum just outside of Warsaw. And occasionally get to go into a T-34, and I do find it... Actually, the first time I went, I took a bunch of my students, summer school students, and I was wearing it like a summer dress. Not a good idea. You know, sort of clambering in, you know. I mean, it was not a good thing to do. I've never made that mistake again. But yeah, they are very cramped, and then they stink. I mean, how these guys manage to, you know, go from Moscow all the way to Berlin in those things, I just don't know. I mean, really, they were
well,
amazing.
Very few of them did, I guess, lasted
fair
less
enough.
Than a week, didn't they? But I'll tell you one thing, Alex, what I really want to do is we should organise a We Have Ways trip.
You should.
Come out and,
you absolutely
and
should.
And see you and do Operation Bagration.
You should, absolutely should. But let's do a We Have Ways trip to this part of the world. There's so much to see. I mean, there's just so much stuff, and even on this
I am
property.
Literally all over that like a rash.
Good,
really
good,
am.
Good. Good. Well, how charming.
But yeah, we were very impressed with the T-34 and its enormous noise and smoke and yes. general fumes.
Yes.
And although yeah. we were in the belly of this beast, and you know, perhaps a little bit closer than we should have been because the 1 meter rule hasn't quite come in yet. We were fairly confident that with all those fumes, no coronavirus has had any chance of surviving.
Maybe this is the secret formula, you know, the cure. T-34 fumes.
Bottle up some T-34 fumes and spray liberally. Yeah. Anyway. But Operation Bagration, I quite like saying it like that. I mean, it's amazing. You know, I've been bullying you about this, about the fact that there is no English language single volume history of Operation Bagration, and yet it's happening exactly the same time as Normandy, pretty much. You know, originally supposed to be launched on the 22nd of June, of course, in an ape of Barbarossa. Finally gets going on the 23rd of June. So it's a kind of same sort of time. It's that summer 1944 offensive. And it's massive, isn't it? I mean, it is so huge. And it is so overwhelmingly successful.
Well, it's an incredible battle. And you're absolutely right. It's very little known. People concentrate on Normandy landings. Of course, there are obvious reasons for that. But when you're talking about, you know, the initial forces of the Soviets is like over 1.6 million troops, and you're talking about the actual destruction, complete destruction of Army Group Center, it's just an extraordinary feat, and it's an amazing. I mean, what they accomplish is beyond belief. All of a sudden, you know, you've got these were sort of obviously the Germans have been fighting like crazy on the central part of the Eastern Front for a year and a half without anybody really noticing. After Stalingrad, they were fighting and fighting and fighting anyway, and these battles have kind of been forgotten by history. But finally, the Soviets say, okay, that's it. You know, and this was agreed at Tehran, after all, that the Soviets were going to start an offensive in conjunction with the Normandy landings. In other words, to try and draw the troops away from what was going to be the landing in France. So it is coordinated in that sense between the Allies. But the Soviets just go for it. And they not only just go for it in the sense that they stick their 1.6 million troops out there, but they also devise this incredible, complex Maskarovka, this idea that they're going to pretend they're going to fight, go into Army Group North Ukraine instead. Hitler falls for it, hook, line, and sinker, starts pulling tanks and troops and everything away from Army Group Center. And so, of course, Stalin is just brilliant, goes through the Pripyat Marshes. Nobody goes through the Pripyat Marshes. You know, completely stupid thing to do, impossible, can't be done. And we're talking about territory, so when we do our trip out here and we go there, you see the terrain is just impossible to fight in. It's basically just swamp, bog, you know, still water, you don't know how deep it is. It's absolutely impossible to get through. And so the Germans go, no, they're not going to come here. And ha-ha, they do.
God, it's so like the Ardennes in reverse.
It is. And but you're talking about an area that's just simply massive. I mean, really, sort of half of Belarusia is made up of this territory. And you know what they do is so incredible. So it's almost like Vietnam style tactics. They get like straws so they can hide under the water with like straws so they can breathe. They build corduroy roads through the swamps secretly. They do this all in darkness. You're not allowed to use lights. So they put sort of phosphorescent paint on the backs of their trucks so they can follow one truck to the other so that there's no signal to the Germans that they're doing all of this stuff. It's all done in complete secrecy and darkness at night. They're moving troops around and so on. It's just unbelievable what they do. And they do build this route through the marshes and then just slam into the Germans and they're completely shocked, horrified, don't know what to do.
I mean... Because we're all very dazzled, aren't we, by sort of particularly American engineering. I mean, British engineering as well, but particularly American engineering and the feats they do and the kind of airfields that get sort of built just like that and in a matter of sort of seconds, it seems, in Normandy and so on. But Soviet engineering feats are out of this world.
Well, the thing is that what they do is different. I mean, the Americans just in the Second World War, for example, just threw money, technology, you know, they were second to none, the arsenal of democracy. It's just incredible. But first of all, a lot of that arsenal goes to the Soviet Union through Lend-Lease. So one of the things that makes the Bagration so successful is that they have jeeps, they've got Studebakers, all these trucks and things, which make the Red Army much more mobile than it would have been before. Plus, they've got other supplies as well. I mean, even food, the Hershey bars and you know, Spam and stuff like that. And it actually makes this operation much more successful than it otherwise would have been, because they're much more mobile because of largely because of Lend-Lease. So that's one thing. But in terms of the Soviet effectiveness, I mean, what they do is, T-34 is a very good example. It's not the most, you know, gizmos and bells and whistles tank on the planet at all, but it's easy to fix. It's basic. You've seen it. It's, you know, it's pretty simple to understand as a vehicle. You can be some poor, you know, farm guy from Ukraine who's been picked up and forced to join the Red Army or whatever, with a you know, screwdriver and a wrench, you could probably get it back together if something goes wrong. And the Red Army really was like this. They I mean, of course, they got better and better. The Germans got worse and worse. And we're talking about the Army Group Center, for example, being at sort of its worst capability by the time you're talking 1944-45. But the Red Army had gotten better. But still, it's a pretty basic force, pretty basic equipment, you know, but they just get on with it and they go forward. I mean, it's so that's really, I think, one of the things that makes them so successful. And of course, by this time on the Eastern Front, the idea of Blitzkrieg and the German, you know, goose-stepping Wehrmachtis, SS guys, that's just all gone out the window. They're lucky if they could get a horse and cart to carry them forward. And
yeah, because they're seriously underpowered, aren't they, the Germans? I mean, Army Group Center's got, what, 900 tanks against, I don't know, like 5,500 tanks, Soviet tanks or something. I mean, you know, they've got less tanks in Army Group Center than they've got in Norway.
Although Soviet experience against German armor, I mean, if you only look at the summer before at Kursk, and the Soviets know this perfectly well, that how vulnerable they are if the Germans have the right tanks in the right place.
Yes.
Don't they? So which is why you've got this application of massive force, even though the Germans are essentially on their arse. I mean, the Russian way is to
smother.
Is to smother and not run the risk of that not working either.
Well, that's absolutely true. But you know, one of the points was that because of the Maskarovka, because of Hitler's mistake, actually, it was pulling all of the troops and the tanks out. You're left with just a few hundred tanks up against the Soviet forces, which was, you know, some. I mean, I can't remember, so 3,600 tanks on the Soviet side and a few hundred on the German side. So, you know, they didn't have a chance, you know, even if Hitler hadn't made this mistake, the Army Group Center was so weakened by this point that they wouldn't have been able to stand up against the Soviets.
So what was the deception that fooled Hitler so? Because after all, you go back to the Western Allies, fortitude and all those deception plans, they're well known now, you know, American First Army, all these sort of things that are part, in fact, part of the way we tell the D-Day story is you've got to spend some time on deception because ha-ha, the silly Germans for all this stuff. What are the Russians doing that makes Hitler bet in the wrong direction?
Well, the first thing was that, as I mentioned earlier, that Hitler didn't believe that the Soviets would be
aside from the Pripyat marshes,
go through this area, and then they deliberately started moving forces or fake forces. They had, you know, the sorts of things that were done also in Normandy: rubber tanks, fake bases. They moved fake armies around, so these Soviet soldiers didn't know what was going on. So they would be, you know, told to get up at night and move and have flashlights in the forest and sort of look as if they were moving, and then they were sent back to do the same thing in another forest, and they were like, what's going on, this is ridiculous. But so they deliberately made it look as if they were going to go into North Ukraine, and Hitler, because he was by this point, he'd taken over command himself. He was really the general Busha, who was in charge of when Bagration started, was fired, and Walter Model was put in his stead, because Busch actually had the audacity to go and tell Hitler that something really big was about to happen. Hitler totally ignored him and carried on with this idea that he knew where the Soviets were going to fight, and that's and that was that. So, you know, this was really an example of, I mean, after the war, the generals all said, oh, it's all Hitler's fault and he was an idiot and we're completely innocent and it's all rubbish. But in this particular case, actually, Hitler made a huge mistake. And then he made the other mistake of saying, okay, well, this has started. Oops. I guess I was maybe, well, he never said I was wrong. But then he came up with this idea of creating these fortress cities. So all these places like Vitebsk and Minsk and so on had to be held to the last man, which was absurd because had the Germans pulled back as Walter Model wanted to do and regrouped early, quickly enough, they might have at least withstood some of this onslaught. They wouldn't. The Soviets might not have gotten all the way to the gates of Warsaw, which is, after all, quite a feat when you look at the map. I mean, you're going, you know, just racing through these Orshilev and Vitebsk and Minsk and so on. Minsk falling was a huge deal for the Germans. And this is where Erich von Bach-Zaleski was based. This was the center of the partisan war and so on. Huge center. They're panicking. They can't get out. All these Germans are encircled. And all of these cities, the same thing happens time and time again because of Hitler's order to keep these places to the last man, these fortress cities. So this was another huge error that Hitler makes. So you know, error upon error upon error leads to the biggest defeat of the Wehrmacht in World War II.
So to
cut to the chase, why is Bagration? Why is it not a headline? But you know, the ink spilt about Kursk, about the Kursk offensive, which you know, and fresh ink being spilt right now with people burrowing right down into the German records. Ben Wheatley, who, and Roman Topol, and people like that, really having a look at the detail and getting right into the about Kursk. And yet Kursk is arguably an inconsequential dust up on the Eastern Front. That of course is then Sicily happens, and the Germans are looking in both directions. Why do we not know? Is it D-Day that overshadows this? Because this is as you say, this is a colossal defeat. Probably actually the end of we talk about this a lot on the podcast. The moment where the Germans have definitely lost, where there really is no point in them carrying on. This is probably it on the Eastern Front, isn't it? So why don't we know about it? Why don't we talk about it more? Why isn't there a single volume?
Well, I think you're right. I think that there are lots of other things going on at the same time. And D-Day, of course, is the parallel moment that finally the Western allies go onto the beaches and they actually start coming through France. It's a big, big, big deal. I think that the feeling amongst Western historians is that the big turning points are Stalingrad and Kursk. And these are big sort of momentous battles in place, and you can understand them much better. I mean, Kursk, you just look at all these tanks going at each other, and you kind of get a mental picture. And Stalingrad, the same, you know, that there have been some great books about both of those battles, and it's something that people can understand. I mean, how many people know where Vitebsk is or Mogilev? I mean, nobody cares about these places. Who knows where Belarus is on the map? And it was a huge, huge war of movement, so it's not. It doesn't have the same sort of epic battle mode, I think, in the imagination as something like Kursk or Stalingrad or even the battles outside of Moscow. And so I think that's part of it. And also there's so many other things going on at the same time, as you pointed out. And I don't know, it's just it's a bit of a mystery. Then, of course, you've got the embarrassing episode of the Warsaw Uprising, which happens at the end of Bagration. And it's something that neither the Soviets nor the Germans really want to talk about much. The Iron Curtain falls and this sort of history is kind of erased. The Soviets sit on the other side of the Vistula River until January, having defeated, gotten up to Warsaw. They just sit there. So it's kind of a damp squib at the end as well. And it's only when they start going for Berlin, starting with the January offensive, the winter offensive, that you start once again getting this sort of, well, we're going for Berlin, this big, you know, prize, the end of the war is coming. So I think that's one of the reasons as well. It just sort of peters out. And as James was saying, the house I'm recording from now was one of the headquarters of Herbert Gila, who was the head of the Viking SS. They were headquartered here in this house. And you know, they just sort of sit here after it's all over and go, well, you know, okay, now what? You know, it's a very strange thing. And the Germans, I mean, they then, the guys who were fighting here either go to Budapest, start fighting in Hungary, or they're sent up to East Prussia, former East Prussia. And so this area is basically more or less abandoned. They nothing happens until the Soviets start moving again in January.
I mean, Alex, it seems to me that the Red Army way is so different from the Allies, you know. What you see with the Allies is this sort of continual broad front, this continual sort of broad front, sort of push, push, push all the time. What the Red Army seems to do is amass a huge amount of forces, pull the battering ram back, swing it in, wham, in it comes. Couple of months later, their casualties are so horrendous that they need to stop and pause again. And they need to build up, start all over again, pull back the battering ram, and then go for the next one. I mean, do you think that's is that a fair assessment?
That's absolutely right. And in fact, by the time, you know, this happens, that this is exactly what Hitler and the German generals are preparing for. The winter offensive, the summer offensive. Where is it going to be? And of course, then this peters out outside of Warsaw. And then they do the same thing again with Zhukov and Rokossovsky and the rest getting ready for the fight on Berlin. And they start amassing troops and tanks and so on. And then do exactly the same thing, the battering ram, this time for Berlin. You're absolutely right. And it becomes a predictable way of warfare. And the idea, I think, was that you just simply, by this point in the war, you couldn't lose. I mean, the Germans could not withstand these massive, massive offensive. And you're talking, you're absolutely right, you're talking about 750,000 casualties in Bagration on the Russian side.
And on the Soviet side.
And almost 500,000 casualties on the German side. You're talking numbers that are just...
If you think that sort of total casualties for Britain in the entire Second World War across the entire globe is 440,000.
Exactly, yeah. And this is one battle.
That's dead. Yeah, but I mean, okay, but so 750,000 casualties just on Bagration. It's just incredible, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And it's so complicated. That's the thing I found about dealing with the Eastern Front, generally speaking, is that the numbers of dead and wounded and missing and so on are just so staggeringly high that very few human beings can even think about processing these numbers. I mean, I'm just down the road from a Soviet prisoner of war camp, which is one of many in this area, because, as you know, when the Soviets were invaded by the Germans at the beginning, over 3.3 million Soviet prisoners of war died in these camps. They were starved to death. Over 3 million. And there were about 35,000 who died just down the road from here in a little prison called Benyaminov. And they're all buried in mass graves with just sort of basically unmarked graves. You're talking over 30,000 people. You know, how many people died in Dresden or Hamburg? You know, these big, huge tragedies that are commemorated every year with whatever. Nobody even knows the names of one of those soldiers there. The only names that we have are of the Italian officers, because it went from a Stalag to an Auflag for Italian prisoners of war who were treated horrifically by the Germans if they didn't change sides. They didn't continue to support the Germans, and so we have the graves and names of some of the Italian officers who were killed there. But otherwise, 35,000 Soviets don't even know their names.
Just gone.
And these sorts of POW camps are dotted all over this area, and this is one of the other tragedies that people just simply don't think about. And it's just the numbers. You know, I just find it sometimes when I'm working on this stuff that how do you even think about 3.3 million? POW is dying, you know. It's just unbelievable. I can't get my head around the numbers.
Now, in a way, what you're describing there sort of answers the next question I was going to ask. Because if you're the Red Army, and we know, because the thing we talk about a lot again is how you mobilise people and how you get people to do what you want them to do in a democratic army. You know, so how did the Western Allies persuade people to give their lives less cheaply or more? You know what I mean? So if the Germans have starved 3 million Red Army soldiers, it's a pretty short. It's the explanation for how you mobilise a Red Army soldier is pretty short, isn't it? You say, look at what these bastards are doing to us, or have done to your comrades. We've got to give back the same to them. And is it that simple, or is it because the sheer carnage and the sheer, you know, there must be Russian soldiers saying it ain't worth it. Look how badly our army looks after us.
This is another point about the war on the Eastern Front, is that it starts from the very beginning. That is from the very beginning of the German invasion of Poland in 1939, with Einsatzgruppen coming in and the Aktion AB to get rid of the Polish intelligentsia. Then you've got the ghettoization of the Jews, and you've got Erich von den Bachseleski starting, you know, saying at Nuremberg trials. With the invasion of the Soviet Union, that they planned to murder about 30 million Slavs through starvation in that sort of border zone, he thought that they would probably murder about 12 million in the first winter alone by starvation. So you're talking about a war that it's, again, very difficult for people who study, you know, the Normandy landings or even Italy or wherever. Perhaps there's a glimmer of it, of the understanding when you look at the sort of Japanese POW camps or whatever. But the brutality, the mentality behind the war on the Eastern Front from the very beginning was one of annihilation. And so when you go in with an army that means to mass murder, but you've also, you're going into territories like Belarus and Ukraine, which are very mixed because they've also just been under the Soviet Stalinist terror. And they want to be get out from under the Soviet yoke. And so you get this very, very complex, murky zone of warfare where you've got partisans, you've got people changing sides, you've got Germans going over to the Soviets, many Soviets going over to the Germans, the Hilfsvilliger people, who, because don't forget the Soviets took a lot of their troops just going through the villages and saying, you're coming with us. If your parents were murdered by the Stalin in the famine in Ukraine, you might change sides. You know, so it's very, very murky, very, very complicated here. And that's one of the reasons I think people avoid it as well, because, you know, it's hard to find the heroes and the villains in this piece. I mean, and the brutality multiplies so that when you look at the, Philip Ludd has done a fantastic book on the partisan war some years ago in Belarus, headed by Erich von der Bach-Zaleski, who was the higher SS police leader based in Minsk. I mean, the brutality, you know, you have the most despicable, I mean, not just people being massacred in hospitals or all that kind of thing that became par for the course in the Eastern Front, but the sorts of tortures, the sorts of, you know, having people's tongues nailed to tables and genitalia cut off, just most disgusting, horrific things being done from one part to the others. These were no longer soldiers in any sense that we'd recognize in the West. Yeah. They become so brutalized, so many of them, and the things that were done, you know, you'd go to a village and see these sorts of atrocities, you'd say, ah, well, I cannot be captured by the Soviets or the Nazis because this is going to happen to me. And the fear, the terror was unbelievable. And in fact, if you look at somewhere like Belarus, the so-called Rolban, this is the big road that goes really between Warsaw via Minsk to Moscow, the Germans never controlled the territory around it. If you were stupid enough to go and stray into the Pripyat marshes, you were going to be killed. You didn't live. So the sense of fear was palpable. So the soldiers overreacted very often. Something that was even a minor incident would turn into something major because they would just go in all guns blazing. So it was a terrifying place to be as either German or Soviet soldier.
So you cannot win, can you? No. You can end up on the winning side if you're lucky enough to survive. But your chance of surviving from, you know, as a soldier from 1941 to 1945 in the Red Army is zip, isn't it?
It's basically zero.
Statistically zero.
I mean, more or less. I mean, some did, some made it, and some Germans too. But that's the other thing: is very, very few Germans went through the whole Eastern Front experience, and most of them died at one point or another. And so when I was doing all my interviews in Berlin in the 1980s of the soldiers, of the German soldiers, most of them had gone in maybe 43 at the very earliest, 44.
Alex, you just drop that in, and that just makes me. You've got to do this book because
yes.
you have interviews from the 1980s when these guys are in their kind of 60s and 70s. You know, it's you know where they've retired, they've got, you know, the kids have flown the nest, they've got time to kind of sort of analyze their experience. It is the perfect time to be in a veteran's life to be interviewing them, and you've got all those testimonies. It's just. Wow. I can't wait to see those. I really can't. It'd just be fascinating.
We're going to take a break right now, and we'll be back with Alex Ritchie in a second.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, US Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics US, brought to you by Goalhanger.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global. global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to We Have Ways of Making You Chalk. We're talking to Alex Ritchie about Operation Bagration and the Eastern Front, history and legacy. How frankly and freely did they talk about their experiences, though? Because if it's this unremitting horror and the chances are, the odds are against you. Because Guy Saget, for instance, is his famous account, or is it, or what, or novelization, we don't know, is you know, notable for being one of the only, or one of the very few accounts from someone from the Eastern Front. What were they saying? Were they?
Well, they were. You know, what tended to happen, I was lucky because I managed to go in via friends, and I also managed to interview quite a few and talk to quite a few when I was growing up in Canada through friends and so on. And you know, they were fairly open. Okay, none of them admitted to raping and pillaging, of course. They were usually, usually saw themselves as victims. As I said, most of the people I talked to were pretty young, and they went in pretty late. So they were in 44, maybe. Lots of them were, you know, 18, 19-year-olds. So I didn't get to interview the top of the SS guys. One of the people that I've talked to James about this before, well, my father-in-law was in Warsaw during the war, but then he was put for 7 years in Stalinist prison. And one of the things that the Germans did, the Soviets did to punish those who'd fought against, you know, were considered to be Polish national representatives of some kind, was put them in with Nazi criminals. So he, for example, saw Höss, the commandant of Auschwitz, being led to his execution. His friend, Mocharski, was sat in prison with Stroop, who crushed the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, and Jürgen Stroop, and my father-in-law was in the same block as him. And he was in with another criminal called the Butcher of Warsaw, who was responsible for some of the mass killings. And so he talked to me about what these guys were saying in prison, about what they'd done and so on.
So they had conversations?
They had conversations, yes. And in fact, Mocharski wrote a book called...
Rather than rip each other's throats out.
No, they had conversations. And what's really interesting is Mocharski's book is he actually wrote a book about sitting with Jürgen Stroop. It's out in English as well. Yes, and
really, that's not on my radar at all. And, what's it called?
It's Interviews with an Executioner, or Diary of Executioner, something like that. I forget the English translation. Wow. And it's in this prison, in Mokotów prison in Warsaw. So I also had the great benefit of talking with my father-in-law about his interviews and discussions with the top SS guys who were waiting to be executed. He was in prison from 46 or 47, 48 with these guys. Most of them were executed in 48. So there was time to talk to them. So he's got this sort of angle of the top SS guys and the Gestapo guys.
And what was their take? I mean,
they thought they were doing the right thing, and they were, you know, fulfilling Hitler's. You know, this is the thing that I find difficult. So the guys I interviewed were young soldiers, most of them just taken, and I didn't come across, maybe they were lying, maybe they were faking it, but I didn't come across these sort of dyed in the wool, you know, we did the right thing, right, and whatever. Sometimes when they got a little bit tipsy and it was late in the evening, and then the whole thing about the Jews would come out, or the whole thing about, you know, the Poles would come out, or the Russians were brutes and Bolsheviks and we were saving the world from Bolshevism. Yeah. You know, Poland started the war. You know, there were all sorts of stupid things. Churchill should have made peace with the Germans. These were sort of standard things. But the real criminals, after the war, they went back to Germany and, you know, put their pipes in their mouths and put their slippers up on the things, and their kids thought they were perfectly nice people. I had one interview with a Polish guy who was quite an extraordinary person, who was a witness to, he was forced during the Warsaw Uprising to burn the bodies that the Germans had massacred in the Wola massacre and so on in Warsaw. Tens of thousands of people were killed. And they were imprisoned and by the SS, and they were forced to burn these bodies. And by doing, because they had to move from place to place, the SS guys who were guarding them essentially lived with them. So they could listen to the conversations of these SS guys in the evening, you know, around the fire, having their Wurst and beer and stuff like that. And he said, you know, One of them was a teacher, one of them was a kind of academic, another one was a real sort of brutal thug, and they fought with each other all the time about what was happening. And one of them said to the other, you know, we can't have you talking about the bombing of Hamburg, you know, because it means you're a traitor and we're going to have to shoot you or whatever. And they were fighting with each other. But he makes made the point that when they went back to Germany, these guys, the teacher and so on, perfectly sophisticated, very well-mannered, very well-spoken. And here they were, you know, watching the burning of these innocent civilians on the streets of Warsaw, and he said in his mind's eye he could just picture them going back to their homes in, you know, Dusseldorf or wherever else, and being absolutely just fitting right back into society. So this is the thing that's so, again, so difficult about when you're talking about interviews and so on,
isn't
what
it?
They actually did and what they actually saw and what they actually thought about it at the time, and then getting them to talk about it later. And this is why my father-in-law's experiences and Mocharski's experiences in prison are so interesting, because these guys knew they were going to be executed, so they talked. But and some of them didn't, of course, because they didn't.
I really want to read that book you mentioned.
Yeah,
interviews with an executioner.
I think it's by Mocharski. I can send you the
send me the link. That'd be great. I mean, I've got a few memoirs from the Eastern Front, and they all go back to kind of 1944, 45, because of course, you know, it's at the end of the war, so their chances of getting through are just fractionally higher than if you're starting in 1941 or whatever. You know, this black idol vice just springs up, you know, comes into my mind. Of course, there's a guy Sayer, but there are quite a few of them. But to have actually had the opportunity to talk to a lot of veterans, I mean, wow, particularly in the 1980s like you have, is just amazing, because of course that's something that's gone. You know, that opportunity has now passed, you know, and it's all right for someone like me, you know, where I'm sort of concentrating on the Western War, because you can go to America or you can go to Canada or the Imperial War Museum or whatever it might be. And there's rafts of interviews to sort of keep us all going forevermore. But, you know, there aren't that many of German interviews. And ditto, I guess, you know, what programs are there in the Soviet Union to record testimonies? I mean, are there any? I mean, you've got a lot of Soviet testimonies too, haven't you?
Yes, I do. I mean, one of the things, we lived in Moscow and St. Petersburg in the 1990s. So these guys were getting a little older. But one of the things I was concentrating on then was also talking to women. Because there were, you know, 400-something thousand women who fought in one form or another in the Soviet Union. But a lot of them were, you know, things like working as nurses or whatever. These women were... One of the things that really struck me, and you asked earlier about the, you know, how did you motivate the Soviets to fight? They were completely 100% motivated. They didn't necessarily like Stalin that much, although they saw him as the great wartime leader but they had been attacked. Their precious country had been attacked. And they were completely 100%, not one single one I talked to wouldn't have given their lives for you know, Mother Russia. I mean, they were absolutely, absolutely, and they lost friends, family, you know, they would put themselves out there. I talked to a couple of women who had volunteered right at the beginning. They were turned away and then they're taken on later because they, obviously the Soviets were running out of manpower or women power, as it were, and they started taking many more women later on in the war and so on. But they were absolutely 100% motivated to, you know, rid their territory of these Nazi beasts. And again, the Nazis behaved so abysmally when they came into Soviet territory that really, you know, it was kind of fight or die kind of feeling for many of them.
Yeah, yeah. What's the state of the Soviet archive, if you wanted to say, if you were... about to embark on a single volume history.
Well, when I was there, I was extremely lucky because this was the time of Boris Yeltsin, who was much derided in the West and laughed at because he was drunk and stuff. But he was really the only democratic leader that Russia's ever had, because Putin, especially Putin, this version of Putin, certainly is not. And the archives were open, and there was freedom of speech and so on. And so we were able to get in, and a lot of institutions. Like the old ladies who ran the archives didn't know what scanners were, for example. So you had these guys from the Hoover Institution just scanning pages like crazy. And that stuff is now in the Hoover Institution in California and Yale and some other universities managed to get copies. Now it's almost impossible to get in. And my friends who are Russian historians, who I used to have quite an open relationship with, could email and so on, I very slowly over the years lost contact with them, partly I think because they're just afraid to be in touch with Western historians. I think there's a sense of of fear and so on. So open digging for the, let's say, more complicated sides of the war, like the mass rapes, stuff like that, absolutely no way right now, unfortunately. One day, hopefully, it'll all open. There's so much material in Russia, so much material, not only Russian stuff, because the Russians and the NKVD documented absolutely everything. I remember going into the Lubyanka, I was able to, in the Yeltsin years, able to go in. I actually went into their, they had a museum for how you fight partisans, you know, Ukrainians with these like fake grass forts, you know, built stuff. It was incredible. Now you just, it's impossible to think about doing that. I went down to see where the execution cells were in the Lubyanka, for example. I don't think that's possible anymore. So quite an extraordinary experience, but the situation now is quite bad. And the thing is that the Russians not only have the Russian stuff, the NKVD stuff, and they documented everything, but they also have a lot of German stuff, captured German stuff, captured Romanian stuff, captured Hungarian stuff, captured Baltic stuff. You know, so it's just sitting there, and again,
it's so frustrating. It
really is, and I don't think that, you know, if we were all of a sudden given access to all of this stuff, I don't think we'd find anything, you know, earth-shatteringly new about the war. I mean, we pretty well have pieced it all together, and we have enough.
But it's just granular detail, isn't it?
And actually, the real shame is exactly the sort of thing, like the everyday life of people on the front, of the soldiers, of the and of the civilians. I mean, we talk about Stalingrad all the time and so on, but, you know, one forgets that there were women and children living in holes by the river. You know, that's the only place they could survive. They couldn't get out, and they lived in, like, little caves they'd made for themselves. I mean, you know, the situation of the civilians in this part of the world was just beyond belief, unbelievable. So again, those stories have been lost because we don't have access to testimonies and materials and so on. So yeah,
did the Soviet state ever do any kind of oral history program, or is that just not part of it at all?
They do. I mean, they do. There are memoirs and so on. But, you know, the trouble is, it's all part of the official Soviet, pre-time Soviet, now Russian narrative, which is, you know, the Great Patriotic War, and of course many people believe this, and this is the line that's followed. But anything that deviates from that is removed or is just not mentioned. So, you know, there were huge Soviet reversals at the beginning of the war are very, very, you know, very rarely talked about. The treatment of the prisoners of war, the fact that so many Soviets changed sides, the anti-Soviet partisan war that was done with the Germans, all these things are ignored. And again, of course, people know about the mass rapes and so on, but, you know, you're not allowed to talk about this sort of thing at all. And instead of sort of looking into it and saying, well, what was it that you know, what were the conditions in the Red Army that made people feel that you could behave this way, instead of analyzing it from that point of view, and of course then learning from those mistakes in future wars. No, that never happened. It was all just sort of wiped over and glossed over. And one of the good things that's happened, you know, from the German perspective, is you've got amazing things like, for example, the Topography of Terror documentary center in Berlin, which is a unique museum in the sense that it sees the crimes of the SS and the Wehrmacht and so on from the perspective of the perpetrators. So why were people motivated to do these terrible crimes? What happened in Germany that actually prompted people to behave in this dreadful way? And you don't have that at all on the Soviet side.
No. I mean, when I went to Moscow, I think it was 4 years ago now, you know, you go to the Victory Park and you go to the museum there, and there's this peculiar feeling when you're going around and think, well, you haven't told us why the Red Army was in Poland in the first place when the Germans attacked it.
Well, yeah, that's true.
And there's it's quite funny that in the way it's presented, because it's presented with simple gaps.
Yes, absolutely.
And simple and the gaps you're supposed to, I imagine you're just supposed to go, oh well, that's just how it happened, rather than look any further. I mean, that museum is extraordinary, with the murals and the glass work inside it, and the memorial outside, and the presentation even now of the Great Patriotic War as the Russian state's justifying foundation narrative, and the new Russian state, post-Soviet Russian state. It's really, really interesting. I mean, we talk, you know, again, a big topic of discussion in the UK is 1940 standing alone as the foundation, modern British foundation myth. But here's the absolute, this is the they're mainlining this idea as the even now for this Russian state, the Great Patriotic War is part of its self-image.
Well, absolutely. And 39 to 41 is, oops, you know, didn't happen. We didn't invade.
Yeah.
And if they do, if they do have to talk about it for whatever reason, it's because, of course, Stalin was brilliant and he was able to foresee what was happening. And he was, you know, preempting Hitler and he knew there was going to be war. So in other words, he's now been written back into history and it's happening more and more. One of the things I find slightly worrying about contemporary Russia under Putin right now is the rehabilitation of Stalin. And him and his, you know, the crimes that were investigated again under Yeltsin and after the collapse of communism are all vanishing. In fact, there was a spat between Poland and Russia about 6 months ago because Putin was saying that you know, that Poland was responsible for the Second World War, basically, which doesn't really go over very well in Warsaw, I would have to say. But so that part of history just disappears. Of course, in Poland, you've got the complete opposite narrative. Everything begins with the Germans invaded the 1st of September, and the 17th of September, the Soviets, you know, do the same thing. And you know, and Katyn is a big story and so on. But there's of course, the issue between Russia and Poland about Katyn still, with the Russians, some Russians now going back on what Yeltsin had said, and even Gorbachev had given the papers and the proofs of Stalin signing on the murders of Katyn. Some of them are saying, no, it's not true. It was all German propaganda. So, you know, there are reversals in historiography in Russia, which are quite scary, I have to say.
Yeah, staggering, really.
Absolutely. God. Yeah. So, and as you'll have seen in Moscow, you know, 4 years ago, you're already getting the, you know, the revised Second World War version.
Oh yeah, yeah.
But you know,
most definitely.
But having said that, you can't deny that the average Soviet Red Army soldier, I mean, what they went through and how they were treated,
is just unbelievable.
And to come back to Bagration, you look at that battle. That is the Red Army winning the land war, in a couple of months, basically, isn't it? And you can't, whatever way you want to cut it, you can't take that away from the Red Army.
Absolutely.
And via corduroy roads across the Pripyat marshes.
Exactly. Yes, first corduroy. Do you mean corduroy? Well,
they're locked, aren't they?
Locked.
It's just locked.
It's just incredible.
Yeah. It is.
How long? I mean, we talk a lot about the teeth and the tail. What's the Soviet teeth to tail ratio in the Red Army? How many guys on the front line and how many people supplying? Because I know I've read John Erickson describing, you know, that the artillery shells being carried up by men. That you'd have an artillery shell in your pack and then you'd drop it at the battery depot, and then you'd go forward to your position. I've read that.
Yeah, I mean,
smaller ratio.
Well, yeah, you're starting off with starting off with 1.6 million troops, but you're going to 2.5 million personnel and people, you know, by the end of the Bagration, you've got 2.5 million Soviets who are engaged in one form or another with supplying and bringing, as you say, ammunition and all that sort of thing up to the front.
It's a lot higher than the British 14% infantry, 43% service.
Much higher. And you know, it's not that they had, you know, manpower or woman power, you know, to spare, but they did utilize the entire population. I mean, people were, and as I said, much, much higher use of women, for example, in all sorts of lines of work, snipers and so on.
But even in tanks, of course.
And tanks, a little bit. But also, of course, medical personnel and all the auxiliary roles. Many, many of these things were taken by women.
So, Alex, who's in the factories? Who's doing the producing?
Well, this is a...
Is that older guys or is that women or what?
It's older guys. It's young people. It's women. But, you know, interestingly enough, a lot of the factories were depleted by the war because people were taken out of working in the factories and they were sent onto the front line. So, you know, because there's this sort of myth, and the Germans had this idea that, you know, the Soviets, they just keep reproducing. You have all these people. Actually, there was, of course, a labor shortage, manpower shortage as well. And they just made do. And as I was saying, the some of the women that I talked to in Moscow, who'd lived through the war, you know, ended up, it's just young kids basically going and working in factories or whatever, you know, barely paid, but they did it out of patriotic, a sense of, you know, patriotism, digging anti-tank ditches around Petersburg or whatever. They just went and did it, and the yeah. population was really highly motivated and mobilized. And so this was very true, of course, in factories and so on as well. They just took anybody.
How were... We've talked about the casualties. How would a Soviet general get away with such a butcher's bill? You know, is it a question of you go to Stalin and he says, well, clearly you're not enough, and your men are getting killed. You're not fighting hard enough.
Yeah, that was actually very much Stalin's view. I mean, Zhukov was known as the butcher by his own men because he killed so many of his own people, and in completely stupid ways. I know you've been to the site of the battles just outside of Berlin, haven't you? Where Zhukov had, you know, put lights in behind his own men, so of course marking them out perfectly for the Germans to, you know, to pick them off, and nothing ever happened to him. He was considered to be perfectly okay, and it was fine. But there were some generals. I mean, Zhukov was probably one of the worst. But that you had other generals who were much more clever and cared much more about their men. Shuikov probably number one in that regard.
Where does Rokossovsky?
And Rokossovsky very much so as well. He was much more professional in that sense, and he did not throw men, you know, onto the barricades for no reason. He was much more cautious. So I think that, I mean, I'm not saying by any stretch of the imagination that the Soviets cared for their soldiers. Their lives were worth nothing. They didn't, you know, there was no notice sent home if they were killed. Nobody knew, you know, that's why I said in the prisoner of war camp just down the road, we don't know any of their names. We don't know who they are. Because they were...
So for most people most Russian lads who went off to war and didn't come back, their family have no idea what happened to them.
Absolutely, no idea. And they did have a little kind of canister that they could wear around their necks with their names and so on. But a lot of them were superstitious, so they didn't wear them because they knew that if they died, that would be the only thing that would...
So the mothers and fathers back at home, all they know is that their son has just not returned from the
exactly.
war.
Exactly.
God, bloody
no
hell.
Idea.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah, they have no idea.
So there's no letter from the adjutant saying, no, I'm awfully sorry, no.
And that's the other thing is, as I said, you know, because of the massive deaths at the beginning, when you're talking about millions of soldiers taken prisoner, and those 3.3 million Russian prisoners of war who died, we don't know any of them. We really just don't know any of them. And there's some amazing testimonies from around here of people who lived in the little village next to me who were witnesses to the way they were being treated. I mean, they were naked, they had no food, there was cannibalism, they ate all the grass on the ground for which they were beaten up. I mean, they tried to get seeds and so on. And the local populations could see the way they were being treated. And one woman was actually killed for trying to throw food across to one group of prisoners. So, you know, it's a very, very sad and tragic situation, but we don't know who they were. And you're talking over 3 million people who just vanished. We don't know anything about who they
were. That's just... I had no idea it was quite as... I mean, I knew the numbers of prisoners that were lost, but the fact that they're just anonymous, just gone.
Just gone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Erased from memory, everything. I mean,
and the thing, the tragedy incredible. About this is that not only, so the ones who did survive, miraculously survived German POW camps, were then arrested and sent to the Gulag.
Yeah, yeah.
And the ones who died here, the only reason that we even know there's this grave is because after the war, the Polish locals put markers on the burial sites. So there are these endless kind of concrete markers with just, you know, 2,000 bodies, 4,000-5,000 bodies or whatever.
So there's just no Commonwealth War Graves equivalent or anything like that in Soviet
Russia. Not for the POWs, because Stalin considered them all to be traitors.
And what about just the ordinary soldiers?
Oh, yeah, the ordinary soldiers is different because they were considered to be heroes of the Soviet Union. And you see those big, huge cemeteries, for example, in Berlin, the two huge cemeteries and so on. But again, we don't know who most of the soldiers are in those.
It's just a memorial to
a big... And a lot of the graves, tombs have mass graves of soldiers as well, but we don't know who they are. But the POWs...
So they're just all shoveled in. They're just shoveled into huge pits.
Yeah, and we don't have records. There are more records on the soldiers. We have more idea of who you know, where they died and so on. If you died in the Battle of Berlin, you're more likely to have been remembered. Your unit would have some knowledge of you and so on. But the POWs were considered to be traitors, and therefore they were erased from history. And that's something that I still to this day when I go, I find it one of the most moving places, you know, in around this area, which is full of World War II sites and so on, most of them unknown or unmarked. But I sometimes go there, just look around, and I'm just filled with such sorrow for these young men who just lie there and nobody has a clue about who they are or you know, and they would have been just, you know, young guys picked up from some village or whatever.
What a terrible time to be alive if you're from that part of the world.
Yeah, there's not much.
It is very hard. You're right. It's very hard to compute into your brain, isn't it?
Just to get
your head around.
Yeah.
The brutality, the barbarity.
Yeah.
The losses, the scale. It's you know, and it's a pinprick in time ago.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely.
I mean, I know the Second World War is receding, but you know, compared to kind of, you know, the ancient Egyptians, Romans, whatever. I mean, it is. No distance in time.
Yeah.
You know, we're supposed to be developed countries. You know, we're supposed to be kind of better than that. And that, God, it's amazing.
Well, and as a piece of history, it's a foundation for some people. That's the other, you know, like we were just saying, that horrendous time the Russian state isn't being honest about, is celebrating to some extent. So I mean,
Yeah, and it's interesting that the changes in the May Day parade, for example, so the marking the end of the war, which when I was there was very much a sort of military parade. Now it's turned into something else, which is interesting, that everybody has a picture or photograph of an individual who died in the war. Most of them relatives, but sometimes others. Most of them, they don't know what happened to them or whatever, but they'll have a picture of their great grandfather or their great uncle or something like that, and they march in the street now with them. So there is a sort of personalization of the deaths of the Red Army soldiers, which didn't happen before, which I find quite interesting. But one of the other problems is that not just in Russia, but in this part of the world, the Second World War history, because it's so complicated, you can choose, you know, we were the good Poles, or we were the good Ukrainians, or we were the good, you know, Belarusians, or whatever else, and you can create a sort of national myth out of it, and the complexity is being lost. The complexity is that there's no martyr state or no group of individuals that behaved absolutely stunningly well. I mean, it is a very murky, complicated, difficult history. And as you say, as long as it's fading, the people who remember it and remember the complexities are fading. And so it's easier for a historical narrative to be put in its place, which glorifies the nation in question. And that's, I think, something that's happening. It's happening all over the world. But in this part of the world, it's particularly dangerous because the Second World War really was that complex here. And different groups and national groups and ethnic groups and so on were mixed up in all sorts of complicated ways because of the isms, because of communism, Stalinism, Bolshevism, because of Nazism and totalitarianisms, and the things that people do under those sorts of systems are so horrific. And you didn't have the same narrative. So when you look at the Battle of Britain or whatever, it really is the good guys versus the nasty Nazis. I mean, you know, you get your Spitfires out there, you get your, you know, daring do guys, you know, with the dam busters or whatever, and you got good and evil, and it's really straightforward and it's all wonderful. But in this part of the world, you get lost very quickly in that mire of evil and despicable acts.
Wow. Well, thanks for being our guide. You're being our corduroy road through the marshes of the murky Eastern Front. Thank you, Alex. Thank you so much.
Yeah, that's amazing.
I mean, it's good to be pulled up on a section of the war that we don't talk about very much, and also just the scale is absolutely mind-boggling.
Yeah.
From the scale of the battles to the scale of the impact on people's lives, and so many people's lives. It's been brilliant to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Great pleasure. Thank you so much.
Wonderful. Cheerio. Thank you.
Cheerio.